they come out of a very, very personal quest, a quest for answers that arose when I was a very small child. I was born in Vienna, in Austria, during a time, it was right of the time of the rise to power of the Nazis. And from one day to the next, my whole world was radically, radically changed. I saw the Gestapo drag my father off. That was Kristallnacht, so called because of all the glass that was broken in Jewish homes, synagogues, shops. But I also saw something else. I saw what I today call spiritual courage. The courage of my mother to stand up against injustice. And she could have been killed. But by a miracle, she obtained his release, and by another miracle, we were able to flee with just what we could carry, really, from Vienna and then from Europe to Cuba, where I grew up. So these questions that so many of us have asked, questions about when we have such a great capacity for caring, for empathy, for love, as I saw in my mother, why has there been so much cruelty, so much violence, so much uncaring? Is it inevitable, or do we have alternatives? The search for these alternatives eventually led to my research, multidisciplinary, cross-cultural, and historical research. And what I found is that, well, something that we hear so much about today, which is thinking outside the box, that the old categories, like ancient versus modern, or Eastern versus Western, or religious versus secular, or a capitalist versus socialist, right versus left, that they really can't answer that question because they don't look at the whole of a social system. And my research really looked at a much larger picture. I looked at the whole of our history, including that long period we call prehistory, and yes, at the whole of humanity, both its female and its male halves. And unlike most studies, which, you know, they're called the study of man, for them we're told, don't worry, woman includes man. Actually, let me just do it the other way because I goofed there. Unlike most studies that are called the study of man, and then we're told, don't worry, man includes woman. Well, of course, woman actually includes man, the word. But you couldn't see patterns without looking at this larger picture. And I called these patterns, one the partnership system and the other one the domination system. Now, what we have been working toward over the last 300 years is moving toward a partnership system. We've left behind slowly, we've challenged many very entrenched traditions of domination, be it the so-called divinely ordained right of kings to rule over their subjects, or the so-called divinely ordained right of men to rule over the women and children in the castles, a military image, in the castles of their homes, be it the civil rights, abolitionist, anti-colonial movement challenging the so-called divinely ordained right of one race to rule over another. Now, the partnership system really is a very, very important goal for us to understand. And one of the main things that we need to understand is that we have most of the progressive social movements, they've tried to dismantle the top of the domination pyramid. You know, politics, economics is conventionally defined, but they haven't put in any real energy, except, of course, for the feminist movement, now the women's rights movement, and now the emerging children's rights movement, in changing relations of domination and submission, of people, you know, feeling that one kind of person should serve and another kind of person should be served, where we all live, in our family and other intimate relations. So the partnership system is really, I would say, the only social category, as is the domination system, the only social categories that can actually help us in this time of disequilibrium, where we could go either way, to understand what we need, which are foundations. And yes, those foundations have to start with the primary human relations, the relations without which none of us would be here, the relations between the female and male half of humanity and between them and their daughters and sons, because it is in those relations, as we have long known from psychology and are today learning from neuroscience, that's where people first learn either to respect human rights or to accept human rights violations as just the way things are, normal, inevitable, even moral. I think that we have to pay attention to ancient prophecies. Unfortunately, there are many. There is, for example, the Armageddon prophecy, of course, of the end of the world, where only a few chosen beings will be transported to heaven. I have to laugh because it's such a primitive mythology, isn't it? And yet so many people buy it. As for the Mayan prophecy, that we will be moving to a better time. And that's also one of the prophecies of some of the Indian cyclic prophecies, that we're moving to a better age. Yes, they do describe a partnership society, except for one very important thing. They too, because they already really either came out of or were reinterpreted during times when we had shifted from our earlier partnership roots to a domination system, they're very abstract in what they prophesize, and they absolutely ignore changes, essential changes, in people's day-to-day relations, and particularly in gender relations and childhood relations. Now, I know that people very often feel uncomfortable talking about gender. And yet, as a great sociologist, Lewis Wirth, said, the most important things about a society are those that people don't like to talk about. And gender is one of them. If you start, when you're a kid, with a model of the human species where there's an in-group of mankind and a female other, where difference, beginning with the most fundamental difference in our species between female and male, is equated either with superiority or inferiority, with dominating or being dominated, with being served or serving, you have a template, don't you, that can then and is so often unconsciously, unthinkingly transferred to all differences, be they based on race, religion, ethnicity, and we see that played out, don't we, in the world today. So again, if we are to really move to that, well, more humane, more peaceful, more equitable, and yes, more sustainable future, we have to pay attention to those formative relationships, both in our own lives and in public policy. see really the struggle for our future today, and it's not between East and West or North and South or capitalism and socialism or religious and secular. It's between partnership and domination. And we see that struggle very clearly. It's a tension. It's been a tension all through history. But what we're seeing today is, yes, we've made a lot of progress, especially in the West, towards the partnership side. We have seen movement away from autocratic monarchies in most regions of the West, except for regressions like Nazi Germany, Stalin, Soviet Union, toward more democratic societies. We have also seen a growing movement rejecting violence as a means of imposing one's will on others. The peace movement, the pacifist movement, and increasingly and very, very important, the movement against intimate violence, against the global pandemic, which the United Nations says is the most ubiquitous human rights violation in the world, of violence against women and children in their own homes, in their families. The statistics are horrific and yet ignored because we don't think of women's issues as important. And that's part of what we have to change, which leads me to the third thing that is really very important, which is, yes, we've seen a movement towards equality of opportunity, equality of valuing of the female and male halves of humanity. And we see that most clearly in the societies today, the Nordic nations, that have moved most closely to the partnership end. It's always a matter of degree. But consider, they have more economic and political democracy. You don't see these huge gaps between haves and have-nots. They were pioneers. The first peace studies came out of the Nordic nations, Sweden, Norway, Finland. The first laws, now this is basic, saying it is unlawful to use physical discipline against children in families. I mean, consider, people wouldn't think of hitting an employee because they're not doing what they want. But these helpless, dependent beings, children, it's been part of our inheritance, hasn't it been, from earlier, more dominator-oriented times, as have traditions of wife-beating, genital mutilation of girls, so-called honor killings, bride burnings. I mean, these horrific traditions that say it's moral, it's normal for men to do these terrible things to women. Now, that's not coincidental, nor is it coincidental that women in these nations are about 40% of the national legislature. And with this, and this actually is one of the subjects of my new book, The Real Wealth of Nations, with this you see that as the status of women rises, you see more caring policies. Why? Because men no longer feel it's such a threat to their status, to their, quote, masculinity, to also embrace nonviolence, caring, empathy, caregiving, which are, of course, in the domination system, unfit for real men. It's, quote, women's stuff. So they have universal health care, universal child care, very generous paid parental leave. That's a configuration, and that's the partnership configuration. At the same time, we're seeing a regression today, worldwide, trying to push us back towards a more rigid domination system. We see it in various things that on the surface, people will think they're disconnected, but they're not. They are part of the configuration of moving back to the domination system. the authoritarianism, and especially theocratic authoritarianism, whether it's Eastern or Western, that is, you know, that's becoming a normative ideal again. Hey, we thought we left that behind, didn't we, with the Enlightenment, but it's coming back. Yes, the reconcentration of economic control in the hands of the multinational corporations, the new global fiefdoms, really, as well as in elites, which never quite gave it up in the developing world. I mean, the gap between haves and have-nots in the developing world is huge. And it is a part of that configuration is that, unfortunately, in many of these regions, the women's movement and the children's movement is just now beginning to gain impetus. Because the third part of the regression, of course, is the rise, particularly, of so-called religious fundamentalism, because it's not really religious, because religion can be very partnership-oriented, but dominator fundamentalism is what it is. And the big, big thrust there is let's get women back to their traditional place, a code word for subservient, in a traditional family, another code word for an authoritarian, male-dominated, highly punitive family, where children learn early on that it's very dangerous to question authority, no matter how brutal, no matter how unjust. So we have to pay attention to these three trends, including, of course, the increasing use of violence, which is so horrendous. And yet, unless we change traditions of violence and domination in our formative, intimate relations, what do kids learn? They learn, in whether they experience violence or they observe it against their mother, they learn a very important lesson. They learn that it's all right, even moral, to use violence to impose your will on others. With that, how can we seriously talk about cultures of peace? That has to be changed. And I co-founded an initiative through the Center for Partnership Studies, which is the not-for-profit that I direct, called the Spiritual Alliance to Stop Intimate Violence. Now, why spiritual? Well, because unfortunately the world religions have been actually complicit in violence. Well, I mean, the Crusades, you know, if you look at the European Middle Ages, they looked a lot like the Taliban, didn't they? The domination model, you know, Crusades, Inquisition, witch burnings, you know, whether you slowly stone a woman to death or slowly burn her to death, it's exemplary violence to terrorize a disempowered group. But the Spiritual Alliance to Stop Intimate Violence, of course, is designed to engage spiritual and including religious leaders to change that. We're not going to change the fundamentalists. I mean, there was a horrible program. Somebody just sent it to me on Al Jazeera of this mullah saying, this is how you should beat your wife. You know, the marks shouldn't show, and you should avoid the face, but beat her. Beat her. This is instructions for how to beat your wife. That's right, according to the Sharia. Well, you're not going to change that guy. But what we can do is to bring a strong, human, progressive spiritual voice to this. And that's what the Spiritual Alliance to Stop Intimate Violence is about. We've got on our council people like Archbishop Tutu. We've got also spiritual leaders who aren't religious, like Jane Goodall. And we are about to publish on our website, which will be saivesaiv.net, is the website, or also through partnershipway.org, our source book, Resources for Violence Prevention in the Formative Parent-Child and woman-man relations worldwide. My research, of course, the first book that first for a general readership on my research was The Chalice and the Blade. The subtitle is Our History, Our Future, and that's what it's about. I'm happy to say that it's in its, oh, I think it's about the, I don't know how many printings here in the US, and it's now in 23 languages. The last one just last year was Arabic, which was really amazing. Now, the way that I came upon that research was first I was looking cross-culturally, and I began to see patterns because I was using a larger database that, yes, that includes the whole of humanity, both its female and male half, the whole of our history, including our prehistory. And I wasn't actually going to go into prehistory. I started cross-culturally. But when I started to go into prehistory, it was just amazing because, again, I kept seeing the same patterns, a configuration of societies that, yes, that oriented more to the partnership side. As, for example, the archaeologist James Maillard writes of Çatalhöyük, which is the largest Neolithic site ever excavated, there were differences in status and in wealth, but they were never extreme. And you see that in the houses, in the grave goods. You don't see these signs of destruction through warfare that you chronically see through later recorded history when there was this shift to the domination side. Çatalhöyük, for example, you don't see signs of destruction for almost 1,000 years. And in the much, much more technologically advanced Minoan civilization of Crete, I mean, that's a fascinating story. You also there see a generally high standard of living. I mean, there are, again, differences in status and wealth, but you don't see these hovels that you see later. And also you don't see signs of destruction through warfare between the various city-states. And the third part of the configuration, and that's been ignored in most, quote, important studies of society, is that in every one of these signs of a much more equal partnership between women and men. It's interesting, the man who is now excavating Çatalhöyük, Ian Hodder, the archaeologist Ian Hodder, he wrote in the Scientific American, he wrote, what you see here is not a matriarchy or a patriarchy, but something much more interesting, something in which having been born female or male doesn't seem to have affected what kind of life you can lead. And of course, long before Hodder wrote that article, in my work, starting with articles and then The Chalice and the Blade, I made that point that matriarchy, as the opposite of patriarchy, is a construct of the dominator imagination where there are only two alternatives. You either dominate or you're dominated. That the real alternative is partnership. And yes, beginning with a more equal partnership between the female and male halves of our species. Of course, it was different in different world regions. But in the West, for example, the last European civilization that oriented more to the partnership side in prehistory was the Minoan civilization that flourished on the Mediterranean island of Crete until about 5,000 years ago. And that is a fascinating civilization, very advanced technologically, the first paved roads in Europe, the first viaducts, the first indoor plumbing. which always impresses Americans enormously. But there are many other impressive things about that culture. Among them, they're extraordinarily beautiful, nature-loving, nature-honoring art. For example, the so-called dolphin fresco. It could very well have been a modern ecology poster when you look at it. But not only that, these very sensual women and men, and women, yes, playing a major role, these very self-assured women. One of the most important to me from the perspective of the partnership versus domination system frescoes is the so-called procession fresco. What it is, it's an image. In the center is a female figure, probably a queen or priestess, with her arms raised in benediction, you know, like the Pope still does. On both sides, on one side are priests, on the other side are priestesses, bringing her offerings of fruit and of wine. Now, the most significant thing about this fresco is not only that the figure in the center to whom gifts are being given is female, but that she is not on an elevated pedestal. Consider the art that came later. They're always, you know, I mean, and by then it's mostly males. They're on this high pedestal, people groveling in front of them, kneeling, prostrating themselves. Don't see that. And that is what I call in my work a hierarchy of actualization rather than a hierarchy of domination. Because let's be clear, with all this talk about no hierarchies, it's unrealistic. We need parents, we need teachers, we need managers, we need leaders. But how is power to be used? Is it to be disempowering or empowering? And of course, my title of the chalice and the blade, those are two symbols of power, aren't they? The blade, well, we know it's the power to dominate, to destroy, to take life. The chalice, very important, but very different power. The power to give life, to nurture life, and yes, to illuminate life. So that's the struggle, isn't it? That we have now. It's not that power is bad. The question is, what kind of power? And again, we come back to gender. Because in the domination system, the archetypes of masculinity, and I want to emphasize archetypes, because this has nothing to do with anything inherent in women or men. But the stereotypical masculinity, it's equated with the power to control, to conquer, with the hard, right? And yes, stereotypical femininity, whether it resides in women or in a, quote, effeminate man. An effeminate man, of course, is already an insult, right? In dominator language. It's a very different thing. Softer, more caring, more nurturing, empowering. One of the trends towards partnership today is precisely in the redefinition of management and leadership that's taking place. And you see that in the corporate literature, which I've been very involved in also because, well, The Real Wealth of Nations is now, it's a book about a what I call a caring economics. And in a system like that, yes, priority is given to caring, to caregiving, to nurturance rather than to punishing, to conquering, to destroying. That's huge, and we can't change the system by just again looking at socialism, communism, capitalism. We have to go much deeper towards what I call a caring economics. An economics that gives visibility and value to the most foundational human work, the work of caring and caregiving, whether it's for people or for nature. Then we can move towards that better future. We have, whether it's capitalist, socialist systems, they're incapable of solving our current global problems. Whether it's environmental problems, I mean, it's not just the Western, but look at China. Horrible environmental problems, and the same was true of the former Soviet Union. As for the globalization of capitalism, studies are showing us that, yes, you know, it is creating more of a middle class, but at the same time, it's widening the gap between haves and have-nots. Report after report is showing this. So obviously, we've got to move beyond both these systems. Why? Because both still come out of earlier times that wanted more domination rather than ownership. And that kind of economic system, control of the economic system, is in the hands of a few, be it in the public sphere or be it in the private family sphere, is sort of a top-down system, isn't it? And whether it's capitalist or socialist, I mean, China, it's state-controlled, but it's a small elite that controls much of it. And of course, now that it's becoming more capitalist, it's again a very small elite of men mostly. Some women are coming in. Iran, again, you know, I mean, you see China, very low status of women again that they're coming from. Iran, let's not even talk about that. I mean, the subordination of women. But Iran, again, mostly state-controlled, and whatever capitalism there is, there are some shopkeepers, there are some merchants, but again, it's a small group that controls. So it doesn't really matter whether it's capitalist, you know, here what we're seeing in the United States, of these billionaires that control enough wealth to feed every person on the planet many times over, or whether it's a socialist communist system. And I again have to go back to the Nordic nations, because the Nordic nations, you see something different. You see a generally high standard of living. Very, very different. And also what you see is something fascinating, because these nations invested so much in caring policies, in caregiving. They were dirt poor at the beginning of the 20th century. I mean, there were famines. Minnesota was populated by people fleeing. The lifespans were very, very low. But because of their caring policies, health care, child care, paid parental leave, they invested in what economists call human capital. Today, they're always in the top tiers, nations like Sweden, Norway, Finland, of the United Nations Human Development Reports. They're also in the top tiers of the Global Competitiveness Reports. So yes, partnership economics are good for business and for people and for the planet. I really don't know how to answer that, frankly. I think that there is a belief that people in more partnership-oriented earlier cultures saw time as more cyclical. And certainly we have a lot of stories about that. And yet time is also linear. I mean, if you look at history, time passes. If you look at our lives, we get older. So it's hard to say. This said, I would imagine that in our prehistory, time was experienced differently, judging from some of the mythology that is reflected in the art. If you look at the art of the Paleolithic, the Old Stone Age, for example, what you see really are indications of a belief not only that, you know, sex and birth are very important in terms of the sacred, you know, I wrote a book called Sacred Pleasure, which of course is a heresy, but it really looks at sexuality and spirituality through the analytical lens of the partnership and domination systems. But they seem to have had a belief in rebirth. And of course, that is a very interesting perception of cyclical. Whether it's cyclical time, that I can't say, but certainly a belief in birth and rebirth seems to come through some of the images, as well as through the ochre burials, which of course seem to have been what to us seems so bizarre, but symbolic of menstrual blood, of the blood that is involved in the giving of life, not in the taking of life. So again, gender. In cultures that orient closely to the domination system, well, take the European Middle Ages or take religious fundamentalist regimes like the Taliban, you have a lot of public violence. In other words, you have people watching for entertainment, really, a woman being stoned to death, people being decapitated or hands being chopped off. You know, in Saudi Arabia, they have Chop Chop Square. Oh yeah, that's what it's called. Why? I mean, it's not funny, it's tragic. It's because that's where this violence takes place. And of course, what this does is a number of things. One, it shows people that, hey, you know, you better be very careful in challenging any authority or you will suffer this violence. But it also desensitizes people. Desensitizes them. Really, I think it affects, because I've been looking a lot at neuroscience, I think it does something to the neural pathways of the brain, the stress of that, so that people are constantly in either fight or flight or in withdrawal, denial. And you see that as part of the domination personality. Now, if you look at our modern mass media, I mean, fortunately, most of the time, it's make-believe, but it's violence. And it's interesting that in these times of regression to the domination system from the 60s, you know, late to the 70s, really, in these times, it's interesting that in these times of regression to the domination system that we've seen in the 70s, 80s, well, there was a break, sort of a break there, a little bit, and 90s, you have seen a vast increase in graphic violence. But this said, look at children's cartoons. Enormous amount of violence from the get-go. This is part of our heritage. I mean, whether it's Grimm's fairy tales, which are really grim, or whether it is all the violence without consequences in children's cartoons. It's again modeling violence as enormously important in human relations. And the mass media have to change. be a balance, because part of my training is not only as a social scientist and systems scientist, but as an attorney, and especially in constitutional law. There has to be a balance between freedom of speech and protection of people's civil and human rights, especially the protection of the civil and human rights of socially marginalized and disempowered groups, like women, for example, in pornography. And I make a distinction, of course, between erotica and pornography, because the human body and the giving and receiving of pleasure is a wonderful thing. But pornography is very largely about humiliating, dominating, and yes, harming, hurting, and even, as in the snuff films, killing another person. And that person is either a woman or a man in gay porno playing the subordinate role. I deal with that quite a bit in Sacred Pleasure and how pernicious this is, because people begin to associate sexual arousal with domination and violence when they're constantly exposed to this, like the Pavlov dogs. And it's got to be changed. But we need a lot more consciousness to do that so that we really can have a balance. I mean, certainly we want free speech, but there have to be standards. Standards, and they have to be human rights standards. And that's really what partnership is about. We have a very strange situation where, of course, we have the so-called war on drugs. Everything is a war, by the way, in the domination system, the war against poverty, the war on drugs. It's because, you know, war, I mean, whether it was Hitler in Germany or, Saddam Hussein or Osama bin Laden, you know, war is sacred in the domination system, and we've inherited that view, which is very interesting. But if you think about the war on drugs, it's a little ludicrous, because the war on drugs is only against a very, very small percentage of the actual pharmaceuticals, of the actual drugs that are so prevalent in the United States. And I'm talking now, of course, about prescription drugs. Now they're advertising them. I always have to laugh, because you've got these happy people, and then there's this voice saying, it may cause cancer, it may cause... It's like, wait a minute. But so it goes, you know, they've mastered the art of really confusing people completely and selling their product. So, of course, if you have a population that's tranquilized, if you have a population, even children now, for anything, you know, the kid doesn't behave, put the child on a drug. It is crazy. But it does fit, doesn't it, with the traditions of domination. Don't make waves, don't make trouble. Just accept. Here I have to say something, though, that it isn't just the drug companies. Unfortunately, much in the New Age has the very same message. The message being, don't worry about changing the world. Just change yourself, and more specifically, change how you react to the world. Accept. Accept what is. Be happy, no matter what. Well, that is really, again, dominator propaganda in New Age clothes, isn't it? And we've got to pay attention to that. It is, on the surface, lovely, you know, peace, love. In reality, it is, again, an opiate, isn't it? In my books, especially in Sacred Pleasure, I write about what I call the dominator trance. I, however, do not only, as is popularly sometimes ascribed, put that at the feet of a prescription drug culture. I think that we really have to look at the reality and look at it much deeper, because our socialization to a very, very large extent, puts us in a dominator trance. So much of what we're taught about history gives us the message that the only thing that counts really in history is military history. So much of what men are taught about their identity, what it means to be a man, a human being who's male, is about conquering. It's about dominating. And here again, unfortunately, in the New Age movement, I mean, when you have stories being recirculated like Iron John, I mean, what's that about? It's about a guy who kills and then he gets to mate. Same old story, isn't it? Sex, violence. Women are very much in a dominator trance in traditional socialization, very circumscribed as to what emotions they get. They don't get anger and contempt. That's a male emotion. They get only the soft emotions. But the most pernicious aspect of the dominator trance is what's done in dominator families. And that, we today know, affects the brain neurochemistry. I think it even affects us on a cellular level. The subtitle of Sacred Pleasure is Sex, Myth, and the Politics of the Body. When people are stressed, and yes, often traumatized, in dominator families, study after study shows that what they end up by doing, not all of them, thank goodness, but many, enough to maintain the system, is that they keep out of their conscious mind a reality. The reality that these bigger people, these stronger people in their own families are causing them so much pain. And then there's this cauldron of confusion and anger and frustration. And of course, they learn to scapegoat, to deflect it against those they perceive as powerless, just as they were when they were children and were told that the pain that was being inflicted on them was because they were bad. So you do that with the disempowered minority, gay, woman. So the dominator trance goes way, way beyond mass media, way, way beyond the issue of drugs. It goes to a way of relating, starting very early on, that continues worldwide, unfortunately, in cultures and subcultures all over the world, that basically people are in denial about reality. And they're in denial that these terrible things that are being done to others are bad. They can be in denial about climate change. I mean, denial is a habit that they acquired very early on about the reality of what, again, they experienced in their early relations or that they witnessed in their early relations. Always amazing to me why sociology ignores psychology and neuroscience. My work brings them together as we must. That the only real answer I can give you is that it depends on us. It depends on what we, and by we I mean every last one of us, not just our leaders in public life or in corporations or in education or in religion, but every one of us does. My books have gotten more and more practical, you know. I, after The Chalice and the Blade and Sacred Pleasure, I wrote a book on education called Tomorrow's Children. What do we really need to teach children? Then I wrote a sort of a self-help book called The Power of Partnership. A lot of practical suggestions, how you can change how you relate to yourself, to others, and yes, also to Mother Earth, and that you really have to pay attention to the whole gamut of relationships. And now, of course, I have written my latest book, The Real Wealth of Nations, Creating a Caring Economics. Every one of us can do something. First step always in any cultural transformation, and that's what we're talking about, is changing the conversation. Consider that in the shift from the Middle Ages to today in the West, words like fealty, obedience, loyalty gradually became replaced by words like freedom, democracy, equality. Now, the words alone did not make the difference, but they changed consciousness. In the same way, when I write about caring economics, I mean, just putting caring and economics in the same sentence, changing consciousness. Every one of us can change the conversation. Every one of us can really see to it by getting on talk shows, by writing letters to the editor, by blogging, all the techniques that are now within our grasp. Change the conversation, for example, about economics. Change it from capitalism versus socialism and North versus South and East versus West to how do we really expect, realistically, more caring policies and practices as long as the work of caring and caregiving is so devalued that it isn't even included in our indicators of economic productivity, so that the life-sustaining activities, whether it's in the household caring for people, mostly women still, although more men are doing it, which is great, whether it's in the volunteer economy, in communities, or whether it's the life-sustaining activities of nature, how do you expect, seriously, to have more caring policies if the contributions of these activities are not part of conventional economic indicators like GDP and GNP. So write to your people in office, write to your newspapers, send them copies of The Real Wealth of Nations. Books can have a huge influence. I mean, look at how Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations is still used and misused, because he did not say government has no role. But that's another story. Use tools. Tools, that's what my work is about, really. Tools that can help us do something active for cultural transformation. My wish would, of course, be that we at least have turned a corner. That at least human rights standards will become the norm, the ideal norm at least, not only for nations, but for families. Consider that when nations have resisted the imposition of human rights standards, they've said, you know, you have no right to interfere in our internal affairs. And the same argument will be made about, yes, human rights standards in families. How dare you interfere with my family? The same fallacy, isn't it? We need human rights standards across the board. So my hope would be that we can achieve that. That's an achievable goal, changing the conversation so that human rights standards are really recognized as being essential for the majority, which is, of course, women and children, and men in families. Secondly, massive changes can be made in economic rules of the game. We can change our economic indicators to include, and there's a movement afoot on this. For example, the Swiss did a survey of the economic value of the work done in households, primarily caregiving work, women doing most of it. They found that it was equivalent to 70% of the reported Swiss GDP. So we can certainly expect that in that period of time. We can definitely expect a change in the conversation about politics and economics to include politics in intimate relations as well as in international relations in the conversation. We can expect a change in the conversation about economics. Forget about socialism versus a capitalism, central planning versus market. We need both, but we need much more than a market. We need an economics that gives visibility and value to the life-sustaining activities. Otherwise, we can't do it. So that's very doable. Spirituality. I write of spirituality in a context of a partnership system as putting love into action. That is, again, a change in perspective, in consciousness, that is achievable in a very short time. The term spiritual courage can gain currency in that time. Because, you know, the way we taught about courage is to go slay the enemy, kill the dragon. No, it's the courage to stand up against injustice. It's the courage to care. So in all areas, we can achieve quite a bit, even in just a few years.